Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. We survey the labor landscape as this week East Coast dock workers walked off the job. Hawaii nurses reach a tentative deal with Hawaii Pacific Health, and hotel workers are in week two of an indefinite strike. Today we talk about filling the pipeline of workers in the hospitality industry. We learn about disaster workers who follow the money and travel across the country responding to storms and wildfires. We take a closer look at a $12 million federal grant that is coming Hawaii's way to help reform healthcare in innovative ways. And we continue to honor educators as we get closer to World Teachers Day this weekend. We hear about the legacy of a McKinley High School teacher that includes her son and our own Lillian Song. It is Wednesday, October 2nd. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. In recent weeks, labor disputes have certainly been rising to the top. Many industries are shorthanded, and workers are clamoring for better wages and workplace conditions. Nurses at Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children are taking a ratification vote on a tentative deal, while hotel workers are in week two of a strike against Hilton. At the Hawaii Tourism Conference, which winds up today, one session looked at workforce development. Taking part in that forum is Tammy Chun. She's Deputy Superintendent for our public schools.
One thing we know about the hospitality industry is there are a lot of different kinds of jobs. So we're talking about everything that includes what might be traditionally thought of as hotels, but also transportation, aviation. There are also entrepreneurs and small businesses involved in the hospitality industry and a wide range of jobs. So it includes IT and engineers and accountants, as well as people who are seeking to be direct customer facing in the hospitality industry. So from the Department of Education point of view, we're looking at students being prepared to have options. Superintendent Kitayashi's focus is for students to graduate from our schools to be globally competitive and locally committed. And that means developing the skills and experiences that will enable them to support their families, themselves, and their communities, and to be able to choose Hawaii as their home. We're focused across the board, K-12, on increasing the amount of career awareness and readiness and experiences. At the high schools, a lot of our high schools have hospitality, tourism, and recreation career pathways. So 39 of our high schools have them, and that provides opportunities for students to learn more about jobs in the hospitality industry. There are a lot of culinary arts programs, for example, and also sustainable hospitality and tourism management programs. Sometimes students are in these pathways and they'll have the opportunity, they're interested in hospitality jobs, and other times they are in the pathway to be engaged in their learning and learn how it applies in real life, but may not be interested in hospitality. So we are working with our employers to be able to make tighter connections between the types of skills that students are learning and the opportunities that are offered them for what's called work-based learning, to learn about what's happening in the workplace with different kinds of experiences with employers. There are different ways for students to get experiences in the field. There are career and technical student organizations. So these are clubs that provide students with experiences and competitions. We also have some large-scale opportunities to visit. So for example, Climb High organizes large opportunities in the different counties. That particular program through Climb High called Lei reaches hundreds of students each year in the events that happen on four different islands. I was at the Oahu event earlier this year, and I want to say there was a ballroom of about 300 students from across Oahu that were getting ready to get on buses and visit different hospitality employers.
And I have worked with so many people who, you know, would share their stories of, let's say, in high school or college. And, you know, if they didn't go into it as a career, it was certainly just part of their growing up here in the islands.
Yes. Sometimes people think that the hospitality industry should focus on hiring students who are not going to college. But I think, as you stated, students who are in college are also employed. Some people make it their lifelong career, and for others, it's a job that they have that provides experiences and it helps them to springboard to some kind of other career.
Are we tracking the success of these programs? You know, if the students then go into travel industry management, let's say at UH Manoa, how are we keeping tabs on whether these programs are successful?
We are able to track students' participation in different career technical education programs in the high schools into the University of Hawaii. We don't always see students continuing the same path that they were in from high school into college. So that is, I don't think we focus on that as the primary success. I think the success is whether or not students are able to connect into something that they're interested in first. Our students are in high school. If they have these experiences, it's helping them to see the relevance of their learning so they commit to the learning and can graduate on time with the motivation and skill to be successful in the next step. We have some new programs that are helping students to make that transition more seamlessly. So one example is there are some student internship programs where students can receive stipends or get paid to do on-the-job experiences in our hospitality industry. And then secondly, we have job fairs in each county in spring for the graduating seniors who are seeking employment after high school.
Are we doing anything in the lower grades?
We are doing things in the lower grades. One of the really exciting programs is at Eva Makai Middle School. Eva Makai has a series of career experiences for students, including one in the aviation industry.
Okay, so it really runs the gamut. We're not just talking hotel workers, that kind of thing.
Yes, it's not just hotel workers. I'm here at the Hawaii Tourism Conference, and the Hawaii Tourism Conference includes the hotels, but it also includes logistics and transportation companies. I'm on a panel with Hawaiian Airlines later today. So the visitor industry really does have a whole range of employers and jobs.
Well, I know we're, you know, in, I think, the second week of an indefinite strike against Hilton, and we had talked to one worker who'd been there for about a year, but she had said, you know, Hilton has a place in her heart because her mother is a housekeeper and has been a housekeeper for more than 30 years. Her brother works for catering, and he's been there for a decade, and she has a twin sister who also works at the hotel. And, you know, you see the workers out on the picket line striking for higher wages, you know, and she shared that, you know, we all live together in a house in Kalihi, you know, and that is, you know, the reality for some families is that they choose to go into a career with the hospitality industry. But it can be tough. You know, it doesn't always pay the bills.
I mentioned earlier that I was attending a session where hundreds of students were coming to explore hospitality. There were several hundred students in the ballroom, and I asked them, how many of you consider Hawaii your home? And almost all of them stood up. And then I asked how many would be interested in living in Hawaii in the future, and most students remained standing, about 75% of the room. And then I asked, how many of you are confident that you are going to be able to stay in Hawaii for your future, given the cost of living? And there were maybe 20% of students still standing. I think our young people are worried about the opportunities for their future in terms of being able to afford to live in Hawaii. They're worried about cost of housing. So if we want our young people to stay, we all of Hawaii, not just the hospitality and the hotels, need to be concerned about the cost of living, housing availability, and wages, and the quality of life in Hawaii.
Anything else you want to add just about some any of the challenges that the DOE is facing? I mean, I'm sure you're getting support from the industry, you know, with these various programs.
One of the things the DOE is doing to make a tighter connection between what students are doing in the classroom and opportunities in industry, including the visitor industry, is called teacher externships. So they're opportunities for teachers to be exposed to the current demands of the workplace. They can see what kinds of jobs are available, what kinds of skills are needed, technology, teamwork, and such. And that's a really great way, an immediate way that employers can be influencing students is through teachers having opportunities to see what the workplace is like. So recent teacher externships have included Outrigger Hotels and Hawaiian Airlines.
That was Tammy Chun, Assistant Superintendent for the Department of Education. She tells us that the schools are also stepping up efforts to stress attendance in class, all part of the effort to prepare young people about punctuality and the emphasis on being on the job, ready to work. Look for links to Climb High and the teacher externships and opportunities for businesses to make the connections with our young people to prime the pipeline for our workforce development. It'll be on our conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Teachers and students in Argentina are going on strike to protest budget cuts to state-run universities.
La universidad, como te digo, es un estorbo para él y trata de sacársela encima.
The university system is a hindrance for President Milei, and he wants to get rid of it, says this student. What's at stake for higher ed in Argentina? Next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Outrigger Resorts and Hotels, featuring the sights and sounds of beaches throughout the islands, live music, and cultural experiences. Learn more at outrigger.com.
This morning, our next guest was just out talking to workers who are walking the picket line at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Waikiki Beach Resort. Socket Soni has been featured in The New Yorker. He's a labor organizer. He has followed the money and gave us a glimpse of the migrant workers who follow disasters across the country. Soni also recently wrote a book about human trafficking following Hurricane Katrina. He's part of a group called Resilience Force.
I started my work as a labor organizer in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. In 2005. And overnight, the Gulf Coast was turned into the world's largest construction site. Workers came from states and countries around the world. They came to repair and rebuild. And I would wake up at 5:30 and go where they looked for work under a giant statue of Robert E. Lee and stand there. And that place in the business district had turned into a hiring spot where contractors would pull up in buses. And I'd hop onto the buses with the workers and watch as they worked. And I didn't realize at the time that I was watching a whole new economy rise up out of the debris. That's an economy that's almost 20 years old now. The way that disasters have become more frequent and more destructive is something we're all familiar with. What most of us don't see is that there are a group of workers inside of that who are doing the work of rebuilding and repairing. And they're mostly, on the mainland, mostly immigrants. Immigrant workers who follow storms and floods and fires, who crisscross across the country, who, in essence, have become the white blood cells of our recovery efforts. And as workers follow storms, I follow workers. My team and I at Resilience Force protect them and also protect the homeowners who need them. So many people depend on these workers, but the workers are being mistreated and there aren't enough of them. So our work is to protect and build up this workforce that we all need to get back on our feet after a climate disaster.
But you want to make sure that they're
paid fairly and treated properly, and that they're not being put in situations that are hazardous to their health.
That's right. You know, we all know now that just days ago, an extraordinary disaster befell Florida and extended out to North Carolina and parts of Georgia, right? Even touched Tennessee. This is not a narrow storm that cut through 10 counties. This detonated towns and cities over four states. And right as Hurricane Helene's floodwaters receded, as we speak, workers are beginning to arrive from states around the country, hopping in their pickup trucks, arriving and starting to rebuild. They're working without protective equipment, without safety gear. They're working in the heat, rebuilding roofs under the sun at the peak of summer. Most of these workers are undocumented, but they're afraid to come forward and report abuse because they fear deportation. And the work only gets completed if they're protected. If these workers are interrupted in their work, then homeowners can't come home. Mayors can't put their tax bases together. So we need these workers, and my work is to make sure that they're not exploited as they do it. These workers are often seen as unskilled and low wage. They're often seen as, quote unquote, just day laborers standing to pick up work, trying to make ends meet by picking up side gigs. That, in fact, isn't the case. These workers are skilled professionals. Since Hurricane Katrina, these workers have gone from town to town, from flood to fire to hurricane. And up on the roofs now in Florida and North Carolina are people who are extraordinarily skilled, extraordinarily professional. And the solution at the end of the day is to recognize them as such. And that recognition is what we usually impart. I just got back from Louisiana, rural Louisiana, which was hit by a hurricane last month. And there, for example, homeowners, the chief of police, the mayor, and the political leadership of the town have all come together to give workers decent wages, a safe space, and to build relationships with these workers. And this town, I might add, is deep in red America, deep in the middle of Trump country, right? This is not a self-describing progressive area of the country. And yet, when it comes to solving practical problems, the residents and the political leadership understand they need the workers. And the workers want to build relationships with the residents and the leaders. In a place where residents once thought of immigrant workers as the enemy, they're now in relationship with immigrant workers because of the practical necessities of getting back together.
Yeah, and we're at a time where we're just about to go into this election, and immigration and what's happening at our borders is keenly being focused on. And so, yeah, you wonder if these storms will change the rhetoric a bit.
Well, what the storms certainly are changing is they're closing the distance between immigrants and those who were born here in places like Florida and Louisiana. I've seen this again and again. Everywhere I go, when immigrant workers arrive to do the work, residents express gratitude. Our work is to turn these spontaneous moments of connection into long-lasting relationships. We keep people in relationship with each other. My team and I at Resilience Force not only protect the workers and make sure residents have advocacy, but also keep the residents and the workers in deep relationship together to build new social fabric that we need in
right.
this country.
You want them to care about each other.
We want them to care about each other. We want bonds to form, long-lasting friendships. And ultimately, we want to weave a new kind of civic fabric. And that means the work has to continue long after the election.
When you were doing the work in Katrina, you spotlighted what was happening with workers from India. And you shared you're from India as well. And so has it changed since you put the spotlight on those stories?
Well, what happened there was that after Katrina, there was an oil rig builder that wanted to reopen in order to service a long line of profitable contracts that they wanted to take advantage of. Instead of hiring local workers, training and hiring local workers, they decided to fly in migrant workers from India who could do three times the work at a third of the price. They promised these workers green cards, but brought them on temporary visas. The workers paid $20,000 for what they thought was an American dream, and they got dropped into an American nightmare. And I found these workers, 500 of them, trapped in labor camps. So these workers wound up engineering a dramatic escape from the labor camps, you know, going on a freedom journey. What I didn't know at the time was that those migrant workers were among the first of this whole new workforce that was emerging as a result of climate disasters.
So you didn't know what you were seeing?
I had no idea what it was in the middle of, and I didn't know that I was at the beginning of something. And now I see it. Those were the first workers that we call resilience workers, the first of the resilience workforce, that over and over again, each time a disaster happened, migrant workers would arrive to repair and rebuild.
So what should we as communities be on the lookout for following a disaster?
Well, two things, I think. One, disasters are absolutely tragic. There aren't silver linings for the people impacted, for the victims and their families. It's just destruction and sorrow. As a society, though, disasters do provide openings, openings to do better and to be better. Disasters put people into relationship with each other. People who ordinarily might be worlds apart are suddenly thrown together to solve problems together. And that's the beauty of that opening after disaster. So one thing to look for is just ways that we can overcome social divisions, overcome our polarization, because a disaster threw us together, made us somehow, even though we're strangers, made us work together to solve a really, really important practical problem that's more important than the politics of the day, right? That's one thing we should look for. The other thing to look for is how can we enact policy that allows us not just to get back on our feet and be the way we were before a disaster, but be stronger to face the next disaster? How can we become more resilient? That's the opening here. Particularly, I think Hawaii can be an extraordinary leader in that. This is a place only 1 year after the fires, a place that can really step into leadership and show the country. In places like Louisiana and Florida, these are places that are used to disaster, places that are used to hurricanes every year. But the response is usually rebuilding homes back to how they were until the next disaster. We need a new way. We actually need, as a society, to become more resilient for the next disaster, to be able to have work year-round that makes us stronger, and not just our homes stronger, but our communities stronger. And that's what I think is really the opening here.
Resilience Force. Did we whet your appetite with this conversation? Sony's Free Talk is this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. as part of the University of Hawaii's Better Tomorrow Speaker Series. And a little bird tells us there may be free cookies available. Look for links on our website later today.
Tech giants, major airlines, grocery chains, even Ticketmaster. Under the Biden administration, the Federal Trade Commission has significantly stepped up antitrust enforcement. However,
whether it's good for consumers, whether it's good for the economy, whether it's good for competitiveness, that is a different question.
We'll look for an answer and examine the antitrust legacy President Biden will leave behind. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiians impacted by the Maui wildfires. Applications for its Kanaho grant accepted through October 10th at oha.org/kanaho-grant.
recently, we featured a conversation we had with former State Health Director Jack Lewin. Dr. Lewin had been working quietly in the Green administration as head of a division within DOH. He was hell-bent on making a difference in healthcare reform. Last October, Hawaii applied for a $12 million grant to help do that. And guess what? Hawaii is one of a number of states to get the nod. HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote here to tell us about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, that's terrific news.
Yes. So I actually stumbled upon this grant because I was looking at the legislative priorities for Jack Lewin's office, which is our state health planning and development agency. And he started to get really, really excited about something. And that's this AHEAD grant. So it's from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And it's going to give the state $12 million to tackle healthcare reform over the next decade. And there's also opportunities for providers to access up to $60 million a year that can go directly to hospitals as well as providers as long as they are interested in participating in the goals of the AHEAD model. And we're one of only six states that's being chosen to participate in this program. So it's this really rare opportunity. And Jack Lewin applied for the program directly, along with Judy Moore Peterson, who is the head of MedQuest. And he has, as you know, because you've spoken to him on the show, a long list of things that he wants to accomplish. And this grant is hopefully going to give him the cash he needs to do it. And one big thing that he said he wants to tackle when I called him up was the discrepancies between Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial health care. Here's Jack going into that.
Both Medicare and Medicaid, federally funded programs, are lower reimbursement programs than commercial insurance. So there's kind of a cost shifting that happens nationally and in Hawaii. You know, the commercial side pays the hospitals and doctors a bit more so they can afford to take on the Medicare patients, which are actually the biggest burden in terms of cost savings issues. If this program really works, in all the programs, commercial, Medicaid, Medicare, there are opportunities for greater efficiency and effectiveness. And if we can achieve that, and save some money, then we can lift up those reimbursements for procedures. We could have a program that looks sort of like Bernie Sanders' vision, where commercial coverage and Medicare and Medicaid pay the same thing for a given service. And it's sort of a seamless system that you can move from one to the other without having a big disruption. You'll have your doctor and your hospital, whether you're in Medicare or commercial or Medicaid. That would be a wonderful achievement and goal at the end of this, if we could get to that place. Quite a challenge, but it's one that's really worth taking on.
And another long-range challenge that Dr. Lewin is going to tackle with this grant is the rising cost of healthcare. But the first step of that is really just figuring out exactly how much we're paying for healthcare as a state. So we have estimates, but we don't have one number. So can we get that number? And then can we figure out how to keep costs down? Here's Dr. Lewin again going into how that would work.
So if healthcare costs keep going up faster than other costs, we won't have the resources to pay for healthcare at some point, particularly for poorer people. So we want to try to, and we're not measuring our total cost of care and looking at it as a state together and saying, here's what we spend, here's what inflation is. Let's try to keep the spending from rising faster than inflation. So we're not, if you kind of think about it in the long run, pricing ourselves out of existence. For Medicare and Medicaid, the federal government's really worried because we're spending as a nation an estimated $4.6 trillion. By the end of 2025, it'll be $5 trillion. They think by 2030, it will be $7 trillion. And if that's the case, you know, there's a real concern. Where is the money coming from? How do we pay for this? So we really need to kind of bring the spending closer to, you know, how general inflation goes if we can. And that's part of the challenge here. I think it's a doable challenge if we get everybody together, but it's going to take collaboration with the insurers, the hospitals, the doctors, the entire health sector coming together. Like maybe in Hawaii, we can do better than other states if we put our heads to it.
And so what does this mean for providers?
Right. And you heard Dr. Lewin talking. This is only going to work if there's a lot of buy-in from the entire healthcare system. And Judy Moore Peterson, who's the head of MedQuest, who applied for the grant with Dr. Lewin, wanted to emphasize that as the state is looking at costs and how to keep costs down, where can we invest differently? Where can we make cuts? They want to make sure the system is working for physicians. Here's more Peterson going into that in more detail.
This model is not to keep prices and keep costs exactly the same as they are today. We have inflation in our daily lives, et cetera. And so it's not that nothing will go up and that we're expected to keep everything exactly the same. It's a matter that the trend isn't as high. I think if you're talking with physicians or healthcare providers who feel like they're being underpaid, they would be very concerned if they thought they were going to be paid less. And I think that's not what this message is about. What we're talking about is investing differently, and coming up with ways of changing the resource allocation so that we have sustainable hospitals and increased capacity and investment in primary care.
And in our conversation, both Dr. Lewin and Moore Peterson said that increasing investments in primary care could make a big difference in spending and healthcare outcomes. So right now, Lewin estimates we're spending about 5% of our total healthcare budget on primary. Again, we don't have concrete numbers. That's one of the goals. But he says if we bump that even up just a couple of percentage points, it could make a big difference. And Moore Peterson agrees. Here's what she had to say.
We have a very healthy state when we compare our health status compared with the rest of the country, but we do have these skewed financial incentives to provide more and more care instead of helping to keep people healthy and improve their health and well-being. So as a very basic example, it's not unusual for hospital executives to look at their daily bed census, how many people are in the beds, and be concerned when they have empty beds because they get paid when there's full beds. But having full beds in hospitals means that we have sick people within our community. And so what we want to do is change those financial incentives so that they're aligned with helping to keep people healthy. So it's really an investment on the primary care side, which we know has been underinvested in within our country, including in our state. And at the same time, also envisioning that you have to think about and reimagine how hospitals are paid so that they can focus on the health and well-being of the community, the hospitals themselves can, and not just in making sure that the hospital beds are full. It's every hospital executive in our state has commented that they really do want to move in this direction, but it does mean that they have to essentially change the business model on how they operate.
Yeah, I know Dr. Lewin is just real big on innovation. It's like we can't keep doing the same thing over and over again, and we've got to find ways to come up with creative solutions to cut through all this.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting that this grant will kick in soon and then carry us through 2035, right? So it's 10 years of folks trying to vision exactly what a new and workable healthcare system looks for Hawaii while we also deal with rising costs and aging population and our continued physician shortage.
All right, so it'll be interesting to watch the progress.
Absolutely.
But thank you so much for tracking this, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
On the next Fresh Air, actor, comedian, and activist John Leguizamo. His latest project is an ambitious docuseries on PBS about the history of Latinos in the Americas, covering thousands of years from pre-Columbian Inca, Maya, and Aztec civilizations to the fight for Latino civil rights. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
You know, not every bird has a great name, but you'll hear no complaints from the melodious laughing thrush. Here's your Manu Minute with University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Melodious laughing thrush, or Chinese wamei, are one of those birds that are much more often heard than seen. They're a pretty good size for a songbird, about 9 inches long, which is the same size as a cardinal. They're mostly rusty brown with a long yellow bill and a very distinct white eye ring and white streak behind their eyes that makes them look like they're wearing glasses. Huamei are very hard to spot because of their habit of loving to hang out fairly close to the ground in dense shrubs. But they make up for this shyness around humans by belting out one of the most beautiful songs of any non-native bird in Hawaii. This song, which can be described as a long series of paired notes and melodic whistles with some mimicry of other bird songs mixed in, can be heard from over 100 meters away and is generally sung by males to attract the opposite sex. Even if you've never seen this bird, there's a good chance you've heard it. Melodious laughing thrush are native to southern China and southern Asia and were first brought here as cage birds by cane workers from China in the late 1800s. Legend has it that they first escaped into Honolulu when they were released from their cages during a great fire in 1900, though they may have been established even earlier than that. They've since been introduced and are common on the islands of Hawaii, Maui, and Kauai, and are much less common on Oahu. Huamei can be found from the coastline up to over 6,000 feet elevation and eat a variety of insects and fruits, mostly from non-native plants. Because they can spread fruits from invasive plants like Myconia and Clydemia into our native forests, and despite their beautiful song, they were placed on the State of Hawaii Injurious Wildlife List in 2014. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. For more than 8 decades, fostering community values that work to protect Hawaii's native wildlife and ecosystems. Learn more about membership and other ways to help at hiaudubon.org.
You know, this week we're sharing stories about the educators who have left a lasting impression on us. Faye Serra was a McKinley High School English teacher for over 30 years. She coached the speech club and is regarded as a pioneer of the Hawaii Speech League. She passed away in 2019, but her son, Darren, carries on her legacy. He has been a teacher for 33 years, the last 10 teaching music at Stevenson Middle School. The Conversations to Lillian Song was a student of Faye Serra in the late 1980s, and she got the chance to talk with Darren about his mom's influence on her students and in his classroom today.
Seeing that light turn on, when I see the kids start from zero musically and then they start to play music, actual music, and they see that in themselves. Isn't this fun? You know, at zero, and now we're playing whatever songs you want to try. And the first week, I tell them, this is a safe place. And we're going to try different things, and don't be afraid to make mistakes. And the only person that gets to tease other people is me. So I'm going to look at you and say, that can be better. So do this, do this, this. And you're going to trust me, and I'll try my best to fix what I hear. And sooner or later, you're going to say, I like that. That made a big difference. You know, and then we have a yay roll where we say yay for each other. If I like something, I'll say yay. And everyone goes, yay. Yeah, they're waiting for me to say that, like a badge of honor. So when I finally say yay for them, they feel like they accomplished something. So they're waiting for it. I go, not yet. I go, maybe tomorrow. And I finally say yay. And they're like, yay, I got a yay from Mr. Sarah. So we always strive for something better every time we play. And we're just starting to, like today, it was only the third class for the new beginners to have their instruments. So it's just barely even knowing how to hold their instrument for sounds. But I'm under the gun because this week is our last week of the quarter, and then you go to break. So my goal is to teach them 5 notes. That way they have enough ammo, so to speak, to go through the book, at least get through the first 10 pages. And then I said, I challenge you to learn more than 5 notes on your own during the break, and we'll come back and we'll see what you got. Because I'm also going to give them their first song. They're so excited. I said, it's not much, but it's something, and we're going to fill that folder with music. Wait till you hear and see the music I chose for you this year. And I'm thinking to myself, man, it is amazing how they go from nothing to the music. I know they're going to be able to play by May. Christmas stuff is Christmas stuff, but the end of the year stuff, you want that change, and the parents will say, wow, you know, the band's playing this from barely squeaking out 2 notes, and now they're playing with feeling and, you know, trying to get some excitement in the music too. So I know we can get there, but they don't know yet. So that's why I need to focus their excitement and get them going. But this is the week, so we'll see if everybody trusts me enough to believe it can happen. I was kind of barking at them today, but they know it's like a coach. I'm a coach. So we got to learn this play. We got to learn this, you know, position. And they look at each other, come on, people, we can do it. We can do it. Like, sure you can. After so many years of doing this, you know, kind of have a, where are we going to be at the end of October? Where are we going to be at the end of November? And we call it a curriculum map. So beginner teachers are still learning that, but veteran teachers, they know where they should be, or at least where they want to be, do all the steps to get there.
You've really captured their attention. You've identified that there's something that they really enjoy and come to love, and then you give them a safe space, like your band room.
Yes.
Dialing this back a little bit, the reason why I reached out to you is because when I was in high school at McKinley, my English teacher was your mom, Mrs. Sarah, and she was a big blessing in my life because in 9th grade, I was a quiet student who loved words but was a wallflower, would never really express myself. But she actually said, Lillian, you are joining the speech club. I know. And it's like, it scared me. It scared me so much because here I am, a freshman. High school is so new to me, but we had a place to go to. Speech Club was my entry point to discovering other people like myself who were learning through your mom. She coached us. She, just like you, repetition, she made us practice. It became like I found my tribe. And just in that sense of, wow, I can do this because I have somebody like Mrs. Sarah being very, she gave us a lot of tough love. I'm not going to say this is all like, you know, rainbows and sunshine. No, we worked.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Oh,
she made us work. And just like you're saying, you need to have that discipline. And she made us practice. And then when we're ready, she made us enter competitions. And then from the competitions, realizing, wow, I did really well. I got notes back from judges, and then realizing I can express myself not just through the written word, but with the spoken word, using my voice in different ways. And she opened up the doors in my mind to like explore other possibilities like theater and drama. I mean, then I went on to college radio, and like now I'm doing public radio. And so when we were talking about, you know, impactful teachers in our lives, I'm going to tell you, Mrs. Sarah just like, boom, top of the list.
She definitely must have seen something in you. And I saw her do it every year. She worked hard. I mean, bringing home papers and Saturday at the tournaments. And her job was her life. And I watched her. And they always say, if you have a job that you love, you never work a day in your life. And she was complete when she was a teacher. I think she kind of got bored when she retired. That's why she kept teaching at Shawinigan. But seeing the kids, you know, they gave her all the mana and all the joy in her life, and she just felt like a person that had meaning. And that was the reason why she was here, you know, here on earth, to be a good teacher. So when I had to teach myself, I always think, can I say that? Am I doing something that I can be proud of? And there are days, you know, like, oh boy, you know. But most of the times I think I do enough that I think I make my mom proud, and I think I'm satisfying the definition of what a teacher is in my head. And you should inspire. I want a kid to come to me and say, thank you for that, or I get it now. And even after the third, fourth, fifth try, you know, say, you understand? You get it? I'm never going to deny a student to ask a question. You know, if they're curious, they're enthusiastic, and they're honest, you know, their learning is through them, not me. I mean, if you only learn what I tell you, you're not going to learn enough. I'm just trying to fight that fire, and you're going to take it from me and say, I got this, and then I don't have to worry about you. But my belief that I got from my mom is that I'm teaching you how to learn, and learning is a good thing. And you're going to be doing things that I never even thought, you know, could be done, and you're going to surprise me. And I'm going to say, that's awesome. What you're doing right now is awesome. Good for you, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have stories of musicians in my career, but my mom, we would go anywhere, and there's people thanking her. And looking back at their high school years, with my mom shining for 2-3 minutes, and I said, they look very happy, Mom. You did that. And they were so glad they saw you, and they gave my mom a big hug, and I said, that's what you did. And sometimes she's like, I was just a teacher for 1 or 2 years. I go, that's enough. Like, you made an impact. Look at them now. They look so, we saw their family, you know, we saw the men at their job or whatever. They seemed like their memories of high school was, you know, 100+1 because of you. But she was perfect for that. She loved her job.
Right. And like you were saying, though, with students who have graduated, recognizing Mrs. Sarah when we're no longer in the classroom setting. I remember when you came and helped coach us.
I was just so happy that she trusted me. I felt honored to take over the team for her, but it gave me respect in that way. So she didn't, I wasn't like a little kid. But yeah, I remember the rehearsals at our house. I mean, it was like a speech camp kind of thing, hours and hours, and then we'd have a meal and practice some more. It was fun, though. It didn't feel like work. I was getting busy at UH, though, so I had to drop it. But I think my last year when I went to Nationals, it was like my feather in the cap that, you know, we did it at least one time. But yeah, my mom, when she retired, she's always asked me questions how things were working. Her presence in Hawaii Speaking was impressive because she was one of those pioneers. You know, other coaches from other schools would ask her questions when she did come around. So she'd be pleased that, you know, people show her that respect. And so she has a, you know, whole line of coaches from under her. So the lineage of coaching, it's amazing. It's been a while since I've got involved in Hawaii Speaking, but her name and Miss Kota, Miss Ishimura, they're the three. And certain Radford coaches, and Kwame, all the different schools had their top coaches. But those are the glory years of Hawaii Speaking, the 70s, 80s, probably the 90s. Still going strong. It's all because of the three women.
Wow. And you did share with me, too, that she actually started teaching when she was 21 years old.
You know, if I could fact check that, because I think she actually started earlier, but I'll say 21 right now, but because she started college when she was 15.
Wow.
Because she came out of school from the Philippines. So I think she actually graduated Northern Colorado when she was 19. Yeah, she was a phenom entering college when she was 15. That I know for sure. So probably my mom were alive. She's like, how can you forget the stories? It's been years, but yeah, she was a go-getter from the very beginning. She was very, very young when she started.
Wow. And so, Darren, when I do the math, and this is just based on my layperson's perspective, but if your mom was teaching freshman English, she was a coach, club advisor for over 30 years, it's amazing that she was instrumental in beginning the Hawaii Speech League back in the 60s.
Yes.
So how many students has she touched here in Hawaii, do you think? Myself included.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Yeah. If you say at least 100 a year, I mean, that's a low minimum. Yeah. Got to be in the thousands. And it's mind-boggling. Yeah. And, you know, you're talking about the impact of teachers. And in a way, my mom still teaches me how to be a teacher. And I'm always thinking of her. So that's what drives me. And I ask myself almost daily, would my mom approve? Am I doing it the way she would do it? And she wasn't a school musician, skilled musician. She didn't like music, but I would say, I think my mom would like this, you know. And my song choices, my repertoire choices, I'm like, if this is good, I know I would say, yeah, good job, Darren. Yeah, you're on the right track. So it still inspires me. It still inspires me to do my best. Yeah. It'll be like that for the rest of my career. You know, you always want to make your mentors happy. But she's definitely mine.
That was Stevenson Middle School music teacher Darren Serra, who was in his 33rd year of teaching. He was talking to HPR's Lillian Song about his mother, the late Faye Serra, who mentored her at McKinley High School. Mrs. Serra taught at Castle and Farrington High before calling McKinley her second home for over 30 years. She then went on to take up teaching at Chaminade University. We wrap up our Impactful Teacher series tomorrow with a trip to the Big Island. Well, we're all out of time now. Up tomorrow, we plan to check in with the timeshare business as the state's tourism conference winds up today. Leave us your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.